Hey, everybody, welcome to the show. Before we get to my guest, we're going to be on the road March 12th to the 14th. I'm going to be at the Omaha Funny Bone. Please come check out a show if you're in the area. March 12th to the 14th, Omaha Funny Bone. And March 26th to the 28th, I'm going to be at Comics Comedy Club in Mohegan Sun in Connecticut. Come to the casino and gamble and laugh, or gamble and cry and then laugh. But yeah, go online to get tickets. Comics Comedy Club, March 26th to the 28th. Also got a YouTube channel, youtube.com/PaulMercurio. Go there and subscribe. Got a lot of great content and putting something new up every week or 5 days or so. Really excited about it. Please subscribe. Just a word of advice. Don't go on a cruise. I don't understand why people go on cruises. Nothing good happens on a cruise. Recently, one cruise ship rammed into the back of another, like two Toyota Camrys on a highway. Like, how does that happen? You always hear bad stuff happens to people on cruises. They get sick. The coronavirus. They won't let the cruise ships into some ports. Just stay off a cruise ship. Why would you go on a cruise ship? There's $800 to sleep in a closet for a week and eat Golden Corral buffet. Really? There's only one reason to go on a cruise. That's to kill your husband. You know, make it look like an accident. Other than that, don't go on a cruise. And my guest this week, Rocco DiSpirito, great chef, and has a really good new book out called The Keto Diet. It's about comfort food and the keto diet. Really, really interesting conversation with him. We talk about growing up Italian, importance of food in our lives, my uncle who runs numbers. We talk about a lot of different stuff, but really great guy. Really enjoyed the conversation with him, Rocco DiSpirito. So enjoy him, and please check me out at, in Omaha if you're around, or Comics Comedy Club, and my YouTube channel, and stay off the cruises. Listeners, I'm talking to Rocco DiSpirito, James Beard Award-winning chef, and author of many, many books. He has a new book out, Rocco's Keto Comfort Food Diet, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. But let's talk about me. No.
Let's talk about you.
Yeah, I don't know. I grew up a middle-class Italian kid in Rhode Island, and my parents, you know, high school educated, and I went to law school at D.C., at Georgetown, and then I ended up in New York doing at a big corporate law firm doing M&A deals, and then started doing
which is the typical training for comedians, right?
That's exactly
what you're supposed to do.
Exactly. Yeah, when I was like
law school.
Right. When I was 20, I'm like, I think I want to get a lot of debt, school debt, student debt, and then just throw it all away. Right. And then I started writing jokes as a hobby. I don't know why. And when I got out of law school, I bought a camera and started shooting, making videos, filming, you know, short videos and all that. And I don't know, something was coming out of me. And then, long story short, I got invited to this big soiree that my firm was invited to, and Jay Leno was the private entertainment. And I went up to him with all my jokes, and I said, "Look, I'm never going to use these. I'm a associate on Wall Street, working 120 hours a week, pulling all nighters. You can have these jokes." And a couple of days later, he called me. He read them, and he hired me to start sending jokes in for the Tonight Show monologue. And
wow,
yeah, it was pretty crazy.
You're self-taught. You just started writing jokes, and they happen to be funny.
It's
all never funny.
Yeah, no, that means
I'm a middle-class Italian kid too. And I just love. That's where I messed up.
Exactly. You should have followed my path. The thing was, it was so bizarre that he called me. Like, I thought he was gonna, he was just being nice and going to throw them away, right? And so, like, you know, you pick up the phone and it's like, "Hi, it's Jay Leno. Was Paul there?" And it was so out of the realm of reality that I thought my friend David, he doesn't do it professionally, just for fun. He can do like voices. And I thought it was him pulling a prank. And I went, "Yeah, really funny, David." He goes, "Not really. It's actually Jay Leno." I go, "Yeah, right." And then he goes, "No, it is." And I actually said to Leno, "You do a lousy Jay Leno."
And, that's a great story.
Yeah, that's how it started.
What did he say to that?
He started laughing. He goes, I go, "I didn't think you were going to call me." And I said, "And if you were going to call me," I told Leno, I said, "I would think it would have been your assistant." He goes, "Nah." I read the stuff. He goes, "There's some good stuff in here. There's some other stuff." And then he started busting my balls. He goes, "What do you do for a living?" I go, "I'm a lawyer." He goes, "I knew it." I go, "Why?" He goes, "You're right like a lawyer. The jokes are too long." He goes,
"Oh, my God."
Yeah, so that's kind of how it started. And then ended up on The Daily Show.
You get paid by the word as a lawyer.
Yeah, exactly. Jay paid me $50 a joke, and when he did my first joke, it just blew my head off my shoulders. I think as you're a creator. I mean, you make amazing things. I think I created this joke and people reacted to it, and it really got me. But anyway, enough about me. Let's talk about you.
Do you remember the first joke that he used?
Yeah, it was about these refurbishing renovation shows, like this old house, how they don't really reflect reality. Because like in the shows, you know, the contractor's like well shaven, under budget, he does stuff for free. But in real life, like the guy's drunk, hitting on your wife, going through your sock drawer for money. and I
never on time or on budget.
Never on time. And when I was a kid, I would beg my parents to stay up to watch comedians on The Tonight Show. That was I don't know why, I just loved them. And then all of a sudden, out of that box that I had been watching my whole life, came My Words. And it just was like crazy. So, you know, we're talking about this. It's funny. Maybe someday I'll pick your brain about writing a book, because I got approached by somebody about writing a book about because there was a lot of doubt and fear about when I did make the jump from Wall Street to comedy and I unraveled my life and I sold my apartment in Manhattan. It was really scary and I had a lot of doubts. And so talking about maybe writing a book about it or doing a scripted half hour about it, because it was a lot of ups and downs. So. But it's pretty crazy.
I'm sure, yeah.
I mean, yeah.
You're going from a pretty solid career, making, 150 grand right out of school.
Yeah.
To $50 a joke.
Yeah, I know.
And those jokes take time to write. It's not like you can write a joke in 10 seconds. It takes a lot of thought.
Exactly. So, you know, but I didn't want to look back when I was 90 and say I should have gone for it, you know, and I figured, you know. And my wife's been super cool about it and everything. So it's all kind of worked out, I think.
Oh, you're married. Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, my wife and I grew up in Providence and went to high school together. And it's funny, you know, because, you know, you grow up in a city and you don't appreciate what's there. Like, I didn't appreciate Johnson and Wales and what a great culinary school it was until I left. We always thought it was like this shithole college, like it's in the bad part of Providence. And then we would talk to people like Johnson and Wales is one of the best culinary schools. We had no idea growing up, or at least I didn't anyway. But
you'll probably never guess that I went to the Culinary Institute of America, but Johnson and Wales was that. At one point, and then it really upgraded. So you were right. Probably when you were going to high school.
Oh, okay.
It went from, and there were only two culinary schools at that time. So,
oh, is that all? Really? Wow.
Well, in the 80s, when people first started going to culinary school en masse, like myself, there were only two culinary schools. And then when chefing became super popular, everyone and their grandmother went to culinary school. And that's when there was, you know, someone opened up the culinary school next to every bodega. So
yeah, how was it when you went?
I was 15 when I went.
Yeah, and then you got
a year.
Did you really? I didn't realize that. Wow,
I actually went to summer school to get out of high school faster so I could get the Culinary Institute of America, because back then they made you wait 2 years. You couldn't just get in right away. They made you wait and beg and plead and get, you know, recommendation letters. All kinds of things.
And then how was it when you got your bachelor's in business at BU, right? Like a few years later? And how was that going back to school? Was that tough, or was that like, you know, something you felt you had to do?
It was fine. I went to France in between. I think being in a structured environment like BU, from sleeping on the subways in Paris, was so like such an upgrade. I was thrilled about it. I was the most ambitious student you've ever met in your life. Everyone I went to class with thought I was insane. I
really?
Took summer courses. I doubled up on my credits. I did 22 credits a semester. I literally finished a 4-year bachelor degree in 2 years and 2 summers. Because after you spend 2 years in Paris living on the subways, and someone takes you from that situation and puts you into Boston University with an apartment and, you know, all that structure and all that learning, you really, really appreciate it.
How did you get that transition to happen? How did you get out of Paris and into
a little bit luck. a little bit parents' help, and then a lot of my working while going to school. I was a teaching assistant, which paid for half my tuition. I had a full-time job also, and my parents helped out a little bit, which was great because at the time, most parents couldn't help at all, you know.
Yeah.
And BU, I think, was one of the top 10 most expensive schools in the country at the time, probably still is.
Yeah, and did you was it like being a middle class Italian kid? I mean, food for us was like a big centerpiece of our life, right? I mean, and I remember my grandmother was epileptic, and I used to have to go home when I was like 12 or 13, and I'd have to cook for her because my mother was working in a furniture business that my mother started and still running. Is that where the passion came from? Just helping mom and grandmom in the kitchen, like when you were a kid, sort of that, would that light the flame?
Yeah,
for you?
I mean, I watched everyone in my family, literally no exception except for my older sister, cook all the time, you know, day in, day out, holidays, regular days. Cooking was, like 3/4 of our life.
So, yeah.
We were always looking for new foods, new ingredients, better deals on ingredients. We talked about what sales they had on canned tomatoes, like it was the news, you know.
Yeah, yeah. My aunt would come over. Yeah. I went to Kachi. Yeah.
$3 shop ride.
Exactly.
It's what fueled us. And we loved eating and we loved celebrating. And, you know, it's the Italian American experience. It's much like what you probably experienced. Every Sunday was a big meal where everyone came over. Every holiday, there were way too many people for the room, the size of the room, and everyone had to bring their own folding chairs.
Yeah.
I don't know if you experienced that. Bring your own chairs. You know that?
Yeah.
You
know that? Yeah. Yeah. My uncle Archie.
That was a really, going back, thinking about that now, if I had a dinner party and I asked my friends to bring their own freaking chair, I don't think they'd show up. They would be like, what happened to Rocco? He's so poor, he can't afford a chair for us to sit on.
It's so true.
Turn over a 5-gallon bucket and that'll be a chair. And he can't do that.
Yeah, we used to do Sunday dinner at my Uncle Archie's at 2:00 in the afternoon in his knotty pine basement. He was a barber. He had a 4-chair barbershop, old school. Only men went, played Frank Sinatra or Perry Como, and had Playboy magazines on the table there. And you go to his house on a Sunday and there's, oh God, the whole, and then he would go into the back room and come out and a guy would shake his hand and he'd pass like some money. And I found out later to make extra money, he was booking numbers out of the back of the barbershop. Yeah. It's like classic. And every Saturday night, his generation, Frank Sinatra was the Justin Bieber or the Justin Timberlake, right? Like they would, anytime Frank would come to Providence, and every Saturday night for 40 years, he would take his wife to the old canteen restaurant up on Federal Hill, which is at the time like the high end Italian restaurant. Yeah. Yeah. And we would sit in that basement.
So not too long ago, that was one of the highest grossing restaurants, right? Am I thinking about the right place?
Yeah, you might be right. I mean, look, it was there before I was born. And when I was a kid growing up, that was like, oh, you went to the old canteen. Like that was like the place in Rhode Island. And
but I love that he needed a second job that he couldn't, even then he had to have two jobs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Even then you needed to have a sidekick.
It's crazy. Yeah. And we'd have that dinner in the basement. And 2:00 in the afternoon, and everybody, my uncle Archie, like four of my uncles smoked cigars and inhaled them. Everybody else was smoking like filterless cigarettes. I'm like, it was just I remember like a cloud of smoke, and everybody's yelling, ah, you don't know what you're talking about. Eat this eggplant. It's good. Like they're just yelling at each other. It was great. It was great. And you know, it's funny, you know,
there's a lot of yelling.
Yeah. Yeah.
But think about it, there's this culture clash constantly happening, right? So it's the person who comes from Italy who's experiencing all this new stuff in the 40s, 50s, and then their kids are starting to argue with them about everything and making fun of them because they can't speak any English or right. You know, they kill pigeons on sight and eat them. And, you know, it was weird times.
It really was. And, you know, when you're in it, you don't realize like that's your culture. But then you have other people that come into your world and help you see it differently. So my wife, we went to high school together. We met in high school, and she's what what they call a WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. So like they're, you know, they're very reserved and quiet and whatever. So she comes to the house like 2 months in, I take her to the Sunday dinner, right? And then we leave. She goes, I go, how was it? She goes, it was fun. She goes, but why was everybody so mad at each other? I'm like, what? She goes, everybody was yelling at each other. I go, we weren't yelling. That's just how we talk. She goes, that's how you talk all the time? Because it seemed very angry. I'm like, no, that's, and I just was laughing. I'm like, yeah, I guess if you look at it as an outsider, you know, there's that, it's loud and it's passionate, you know. But the thing that I found, and I wanted to tie into what you've been doing, God, going back to, I think, 2006, and the idea of healthy eating is, you know, my mom would always cook like basic stuff, you know, broccoli rabe, oil, a little garlic, salt. It was always a very basic but healthy meal growing up as part of the Italian diet. And I assume it was the same with you. And I know, you know, going back, you know, you said back in, you know, around 2006, I know you weren't well, you had some back issues, and you said a quote of yours is, all the things I write about in my books, I've been hungry to show people. I've been pitching this idea of healthy meals to restaurants and food companies, and I started that in 2006. Did that come out of your upbringing and seeing how healthy the Italians cook and eat?
I didn't realize healthy Italian food was so healthy until later in life. I didn't realize how special and what a treasure growing up in that environment was until really my early to mid-30s. I suffered from ethnic self-loathing for 32 years at minimum. So I went to France to learn how to cook, and you know, my first second language was French, and I didn't even bother to learn Italian properly. That's how frustrated I was with my Italian heritage, because I looked at my family and even though I shouldn't have, I felt disappointed often because they didn't know what the SATs were, for example. You know, I remember going to school one day and everyone was saying, okay, well, you ready for the SAT? And I was like, what's the SAT? And, you know, normally your parents help you prep for that kind of thing. And they're talking about it from first grade. And so I gave myself a lot of excuses to be upset with my family. And then in my 30s, when I'd been cooking French food for nearly 15 years after living in France and all that, I saw what my family was still doing, which was living like they lived in Campania, and thought, this is the jam. I mean, this is great. They're still making artisanal foods that are mostly homemade from, you know, natural ingredients. And back then there were no organic and conventional ingredients. Everything was just relatively pesticide free and you know, until we got into later 80s, 90s and early 2000s. So I was inspired by them, but I didn't realize it until later on. And when I look back, I definitely understand that watching my aunt, uncle, mother, father, grandmother, even my older cousins cooking all that delicious food had a big impact on me. Absolutely had a big impact on me. I'd give anything to be able to go back to one of those Sunday dinners right now and relive those moments. But of course, at the time, you don't appreciate it. Just like you said, in Rhode Island, you thought it was normal.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Fresh grated Parmigiano Reggiano. Do you understand how few people know what that looks and smells and tastes like?
Yeah, I know. I know.
Most people get their parm from a green tube.
Yeah. I can remember being a kid and my mother would get the hamburger, throw it in the bowl, she'd crack an egg, throw some breadcrumbs, cut up some garlic, parsley, and she goes, okay, go. And I put my hands in and I'd have to mix it all because we were making the meatballs. And I remember how cold it was, like my hands would freak. Yeah. And then I'd pull them out and I'd like rub them like I was in the Arctic. And then I'd go back in and then I'd roll the meatballs. And she goes, and I remember her saying, you know, we don't cook them all the way because then we're going to put them in the gravy. We called it gravy. I don't know if you guys call it gravy.
Yeah.
And then it's going to cook more in the gravy. And then it would come out, and that was like whatever. And then I went to Rao's like for the first time a few months ago, and it was good. And I had the meatball. You got to have the meatball. And I got to be honest with you, it was my mother's meatball. You know what I mean? Like it was great.
But, exactly. Yeah, we all made the same damn meatball.
You know, it just broke apart beautifully.
The ears are just super size.
Yeah, exactly.
Huge. Yeah.
Well, the big treat was when she'd make the gravy, you get the Italian bread and you rip off a piece of that and you start dipping it. By the time I did that, I wasn't even hungry for the meal because I ate like half a loaf of bread. But anyway.
And three undercooked meatballs.
Exactly. Tell people about the book a little bit. I want to make sure that we talk about that. I mean, it's
yeah,
focused
sure, no problem.
On the keto diet. And I know, explain to people who may not be that familiar with the diet. I mean, my understanding is it was actually like sort of a dietary therapy for people who were suffered from epilepsy, and it's sort of grown into this, you know, more broader diet that people are on. And what was your motivation for wanting to kind of put a book out about it?
So it's interesting that you say that because a lot of people now know what a keto diet is, or at least have heard about it.
Yeah,
which was what gave me the confidence to use the word keto on the cover. I've written, I think it's 10 health and wellness books now, and each of them employed some element of the keto diet. My book, The Power Day Diet, is a keto diet book. But at that time in 2012, I believe, we didn't feel comfortable enough with the general public's knowledge of keto or the term keto to use it on the cover. And right now on the cover of a book, you want to create your best slogan, and your best sales pitch, and you want to make sure that people can understand it easily and quickly absorb the content. But now keto has popped off. I mean, everyone is doing keto. People generally know what it's about. They know it's a high fat, low carb diet, and they know that it not only causes rapid weight loss, but it's also causes mood enhancement and reverses diabetes, and there are hundreds of therapeutic benefits. So when we were talking about this book, I felt very comfortable using the word keto for the first time. You know, it takes 2 to 3 years to get a book out. So 3 years ago, I didn't feel comfortable using the term keto, and now I do. And it's funny because when I'm talking to people about it now, whether it's like a radio interview or a podcast interview like yours or another interview, everyone says, oh, I'm on the keto diet. I'm doing keto. I'm so happy, you know, you wrote a keto book. I'm like, I've written 8 keto books, but this is the first one that has keto on the title. But it's great. No, it's great because I'm always pushing people a little further than they're probably comfortable with. And most of my work in life in general, I'm always trying to lead people to a finer, better, new place, just a little bit, sometimes a lot. When I was cooking at Union Pacific, all I did was challenge people with my food. Mm-hmm. And with my books, I try to bring people to places that they may not have thought of on their own. You know, I wrote a book called Cook Your Butt Off, where you can burn calories while you cook. People don't realize that cooking is a calorie burning exercise. And your heart rate goes up. And so I created recipes that literally contained less calories than you burn cooking them. Right? That's pretty out there, right?
Yeah.
So it was nice. It was nice to be able to, first of all, cull all the best recipes from my previous books, the ones that got the most positive reaction, turn them into keto versions of themselves, and do something that is going to be very comfortable for most people.
Are there any misconceptions about the diet that you tried to address in the book? Because again, a lot of times, especially with the internet now, everybody thinks we know, we all think we know everything because we Googled something and read 2 sentences, but like what myths did you want to try to dispel?
So there's something called keto flu, that is hilarious. Anytime you change diets drastically, in this case, you're going from being a carb burner to a fat burner. That's mm-hmm. a big change in terms of your chemistry. Mm-hmm. And that big physiological change, you know, it involves the brain, the respiratory system. You're going to feel something, right? And people feel something, when they change anything, start drinking a lot of water or take coffee out of their life. So when you're going from eating a lot of carbs to almost no carbs, you're bound to feel something. And people have called it the keto flu. A lot of people think it's an actual flu where you're going to get a viral infection. So all it is the symptoms and side effects of making a big change and resetting your body to prepare it for a keto lifestyle. I've got a three-day reset in my book that helps you get through that. And I use a lot of bone broth, which is very fortifying and very satisfying and comforting. So between the bone broth and the keto coffee and the reset, I get you through the keto flu. There's also something called keto crotch that is crazy. I think people just love the alliteration of this. So keto crotch is apparently a change in the odor of one's crotch while they're on a keto diet. So here's the thing. It's neither bad nor good. It's simply a change. And no one's going to notice it. It's not a big deal. And I've been asked about it way too many times. I think people just love saying keto crotch. So don't worry about that. That's not a big deal. There is a change in breath when you start burning keto bodies, which is what your body creates when you switch from carbs to fat. It creates ketone and keto bodies. That's the actual fuel that is burned. Your breath can change, not permanently, but temporarily. Mm-hmm. And so that's an actual truth. That's not a myth and something you just want to look out for. But I'm talking 24 hours, maybe. Then the other biggest misconception is that this is the Atkins diet and Dr. Atkins died of heart disease. So the modern version of a keto diet includes a lot of good carbs. It doesn't eliminate all the good carbs like the Atkins diet did. In the Atkins diet, you literally had to eat bacon and steak and eggs and cheese, and that was all that was allowed. But if you look at my recipes, you'll see lots of plant-based food in there, lots of leafy green vegetables, lots of cauliflower and broccoli and mushrooms, because those are all fine. Those carbs are considered safe and fine for a keto diet. It's the starchy carbs that you want to stay away from, the empty calorie starchy carbs like French fries, rice, pasta, the bread, those kinds of things. You can eventually put those back into your diet, but you want to try to get to your goal weight. And the best part, and it's not a misconception because I think most people know that keto works fast but don't believe it, is that keto works really fast. You can get into ketosis in less than 24 hours. You could be burning a pound to 2 pounds of fat per day for, weeks at a time. So it's a very effective way to burn excess fat.
How long do you have to be on the diet for it to kick in and start to work?
Well, that's a good question. And it's a question for every diet. So diet ultimately has to become transformation. If you're eating foods that cause weight gain and you're not exercising enough to burn the surplus calories that those foods provide, you're going to have to transform into a isocaloric balance, it's called, into a lifestyle of eating and working out that provides isocaloric balance, which means you consume X calories and you burn X calories every day. If you're consuming X plus 1,000 calories and not burning, you're burning X minus 1,000, you're going to always gain weight. You have to get into isocaloric balance at some point, no matter what diet you do. The beautiful thing about growing up Italian is that the Mediterranean diet pattern is literally the most balanced diet there is. And if you could just get into that pattern, that is sustainable for life and you never have to change it. But most people are not going to eat that many fruits and vegetables and that little meat and that little fat. But, if you go to Italy, there's no real problem with obesity. People still cook at home a lot. They still eat a lot of homegrown, home-produced foods. Mm-hmm. Home-produced foods and preserves are kind of like currency there. People exchange a lot of it with each other. Cans of tomatoes, vegetables, fruit preserves. They're still living a like contadina, farmer lifestyle in many ways, and that's why Italy, Spain, France don't have obesity issues. So there's going to be some amount of time on a keto diet, especially my keto diet, where you're going to lose weight rapidly. Mm-hmm. It can be anywhere from 3 days to 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking as rapid as a pound a day, maybe more. And then it'll start to slow down and you'll have to move from tier one to tier two to tier three. And then at some point you want to add exercise in. And then in maintenance, where we add all the desserts back in, you're going to have to add exercise to maintain whatever it is you've achieved. And that's true for any diet. There's no diet that without severe calorie restriction works for life, unless it's the Mediterranean diet plan. Diets are transformational. Diets are a jump start into transformation.
To a transformational lifestyle in the overall. And so is it okay to be exercising when you start the keto diet? Like if you're a person that regularly exercises anyway, is it okay to do the, or should you back off exercising in the beginning of the diet and then bring the exercise in later?
This diet works with exercise. If you wanted to give yourself a break, a keto diet is, you know, starting a keto diet is a good time to give yourself a break. I prefer you include intermittent fasting, which I talk about in this book to a great deal, which is where you don't eat for 12 hours every day. So you basically condense all your eating into, the early part of the day. You stop eating by, 2, 3, 4, 5 o'clock, and you don't eat again until the next morning. So I'd rather you do that as a form of exercise than exercise, because you can confuse your body. Exercise does require carbs depending on the exercise. So there's a whole bunch of science that we'd have to get into to explain this fully, but basically there's anaerobic and aerobic exercise. One burns carbs, one doesn't. One burns fat, and if you can keep your heart rate between 60 and 70% of its max heart rate, then you can do that exercise. Mm-hmm. But, for a lot of people, that's just way too much to add to changing an entire, menu for yourself. I would say start with the recipes, try those recipes, drink the coffee in the morning, make the bone broth. Those are really well worth the effort. See if we're getting results. If you're getting results, don't worry about the exercise for the first few weeks. At some point, you got to add exercise back in your life, though, because it's just good for you for many reasons other than weight loss.
Absolutely. There's so much here, Rocco. Thank you. We will, I want to have you back on. We'll talk some more about the book and all the other great things you've been doing. The book is Rocco Dispirito's latest book, and it is focuses on the keto diet. It's Rocco's keto comfort food diet. Eat the food you miss, and you'll still lose up to a pound a day. It's out now. Get it everywhere. And best of luck, and let's get back together and do this again.
All right. Sounds good. I appreciate it.
All right. There you go. Rocco Dispirito. What a great guy. I'm having him on again because there's so much stuff I wanted to talk to him about. And the book looks really good. And I've already started to use some recipes in it. So check it out. It's really great. And check out my YouTube channel, youtube.com/PaulMercurio. You can subscribe there. And also mid-March, March 12th to the 14th in Omaha at the Funny Bone, and March 26th to the 28th at the Comics Comedy Club in Mohegan Sun. All right, guys. See you next week. Thanks for checking out the podcast.